Today's podcast is sponsored by RadRx, your source for quality online education for interventional and diagnostic radiology coding, taught by subject matter expert Stacy Buck. For more information and testimonials, visit RadRx.com. Struggling to learn interventional radiology coding? If so, RadRx has the perfect solution for you. Cracking the IR Code, Mastering Interventional Radiology and Cardiology online training program. In this program, interventional radiology coding expert Stacy Buck breaks down the complexities of interventional radiology coding in easy-to-understand terms so you can grasp this complex specialty. Through her course, Stacy has assisted many coders with little or no interventional radiology coding experience in successfully passing the CIRC exam on the first attempt. For additional information and testimonials, visit RadRx.com. Welcome to Who Cares What Stacy Says, a podcast providing insights and advice on how to take your medical coding career to the next level. And now, here's your host, Stacy Buck.
Welcome to another episode of Who Cares What Stacy Says. I am your host, Stacy Buck. Before I introduce today's episode, I want to take a moment to announce the launch of a brand new podcast called Coding Consultant Confessions. Coding Consultant Confessions is hosted by yours truly, along with Tony L. Holmes of Alpha Coding Experts and Victoria Mull of Contempo Coding. It is such an honor to be collaborating with these two industry superstars. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform and on YouTube. Just search for the Coding Consultant Confessions by name. Our first official episode dropped on May 18th, and our second episode drops on June 1st. Get ready for some great expert advice along with lots of laughs. Please give Coding Consultant Confessions a listen and share with all of your friends. Now, back to Who Cares What Stacy Says. In today's episode, I am joined by Eric Rubenstein, Director of Litigation and Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support at Advise. Eric is a former OIG agent. Warning, this episode is longer than normal because Eric and I had to break our recording session into two separate sessions due to a scheduling conflict. Rather than chop up two sessions to create three episodes, which can be labor intensive, I decided to leave the interview as a two-part episode, each of which will be of extended length. However, you will be surprised at how fast the time passes while listening, as the interview is jam-packed with valuable information and interesting stories from Eric's time spent as an OIG agent. In part one of our interview, Eric shares the story of his career path, working first as a corrections officer, then a federal probation and parole officer, and eventually an OIG agent. We also discuss the importance of auditing, and he provides his expert advice for medical coders who may find themselves caught in the middle of those sticky situations where an employer is engaging in questionable billing and coding practices, including how to properly document those questionable actions and how to CYA so the finger doesn't come pointing back at you after quitting or being let go. And now here is part one of my interview with Eric Rubenstein. Welcome everyone to another episode of Who Cares What Stacy Says. Today, I am happy to have Eric Rubenstein with me. Eric and I actually have never spoken before. This is the first time we'll be having a conversation. I first learned of him through the Chuckleheads podcast. A lot of you out there probably listen to Coffee, Compliance, and Chuckleheads with Eric and Sean Weiss and Jordan Johnson. And you guys, I have to say, just do such a great podcast. It's very informative, lots of great information, and you entertain at the same time, which I love. I love the sense of humor that all of you have and how you kind of play off of each other. Although I have to say, I feel like you pick on Jordan a little bit too much. Like, I feel like he might be the punching bag of the group. What do you have to say about that?
The punching bag of the group from me or the punching bag of the group from me and Sean? Because I am often reminded of the fact that I pick on Jordan a lot. Yeah, he gets a little bit of picking on. But I will tell you that I pick on him the same when we're doing our podcast as when I do it when we're in person or when we're talking on the phone or just doing some of our prep meetings and stuff. So the genuine person that you see in the podcast It's just as brutal as it is in person. I'm a New Yorker, and so I have a skin that's about this thick. And so if you can dish it out, you must be able to take it. So, you know, that's just the way it is. But yeah, it is what it is on that podcast.
Yeah, I like that. That's one thing that I admire about men is they have the ability to go at each other like that and nobody gets their feelings hurt over it. And they can, like, you know, take it and dish it out. Women, that's a little bit more difficult. Like, I kind of have that sense of humor and you sometimes have to be careful where you go with that. But no, you guys make a great team. And so I'm enjoying the podcast. I know a lot of other people out there are enjoying the podcast. So I wanted to have you on the podcast mainly because of your experience working with the OIG. I have loved listening to your stories and experiences there. And I know my audience is mainly medical coders. And there's always this fascination about OIG and what goes on behind the scenes. And then also, you know, how coders can get into working with the OIG and being a part of that whole investigative process. But before we get into that, can you share with my audience a little bit about your background, how you got into healthcare? You know, did you plan on working for the OIG? Is it something that just came up? Like, what was your initial plan going into your career?
Yeah, great. You know, it is interesting because everybody has this fascination because everybody who works in the healthcare fraud, waste, abuse world always hears about the OIG and kind of sees them at a distance. And then when you finally actually talk to people who worked for the OIG in different capacities, you learn these sort of granular things that either will debunk or confirm things that you learned on the way. You know, I got to the OIG in February of 1997 was my start date. I have an undergraduate degree in government, political science. I have a master's degree in criminal justice, sociology. I was on a path to either go to law school or graduate school and went to graduate school and was actually in the process of transferring from where I went to get my master's. I was in the process of applying and getting my credits accepted to get my PhD and was going sort of through the process of what credits will they accept, what credits will they not accept. And it was in the early 90s and the job market was not great for law enforcement. And I actually got my very first job in the government was working as a federal corrections officer at a penitentiary in the middle of Pennsylvania, to which everybody that I knew thought I was insane for taking the job. But I packed up my stuff and I moved out. Like, it was literally in the middle of the state of Pennsylvania with nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to see here kind of a deal. And I worked at what was the second highest security level in the country for 15 months. It was a great eye-opening experience. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about how to talk to people and deal with people because it was not a club fed. It was a penitentiary with people who were there for very serious crimes in a long time. But I knew that when I got it, that was the day I was going to leave. I had been an EMT in college and graduate school. I paid my way through part of school working as an EMT and an advanced EMT paramedic in New York. And so I knew enough about the medical field to, you know, to do the emergency type stuff. But ultimately, I wound up getting a job as a federal probation and parole officer in Brooklyn, New York. In the Eastern District of New York, where I had been there for about 2 years. I knew about OIGs just because I was always looking for an agent position and actually got to work on a case involving the sentencing of some defendants that were involved in some healthcare fraud and thought, man, this is pretty interesting. I'm already an EMT. I'm already kind of doing some medical stuff. I kind of know the terminology. This looks like it would be a lot of fun to do. And I actually applied to HHS OIG during the second phase of something called Operation Restore Trust, which had started in 1995. So for those of you that were around that long ago and remember.
I remember that. I remember.
Yeah, yeah. So you and me and everybody else who's on Geritol remembers. But it was, you know, it resulted as a change in Social Security Administration was part of HHS, which a lot of people did not know or don't know. But the Social Security Administration split from HHS in 1995, and they split up the organization. And if you were an agent working predominantly Social Security fraud cases, you went to Social Security. If you were an agent working predominantly healthcare cases, you went over to HHS OIG. And so 1995 was that split. The first round of hiring occurred, and then I was hired sort of in the second big batch, which was in February of 97, and then stayed there until I retired in January of 19. I started in New York. I was there from February of 97 until 2003. I had a trial that occurred in 2002 in Southern District, and then after that, I got a transfer to an office we had in New Jersey and I remained there until I retired in January of 19.
So before we talk about the OIG experience, what are you doing now? Where, you know, I obviously know you work for Advise, but in your role with Advise, mm-hmm. what are you currently doing?
Yeah, so I retired in January of 19 because it was time. I got recruited through Advise. I got recruited to go work on a contract with IBM. So I started off with Advise, but really working a combination of two things. One was on a contract with IBM as a healthcare fraud subject matter expert on a contract that they had with CMS to develop a case management tool, but stayed with Advise that whole time. That contract ended. And then I went for a little bit, still staying with Advise, doing very kind of specific work with the Healthcare Fraud Prevention Partnership, where I was there for about 14 months. And then it just got to be too much, the projects I was working on for Advise and HFPP. So I left that and have been sort of Advise full time, but it always been in capacity for the past 3 years. My title is Director of Litigation, Waste, Fraud, and Abuse Support. Really what I do is I work a lot on the provider side now with law firms, mm-hmm. everything from self-disclosures, helping with corrective action plans and implementing corrective action plans. We do a ton of proactive audit work on behalf of providers, whether it be a couple of times a year, quarterly. We have a couple of providers we do monthly work for, including training and education, keeping in mind those very important seven elements of the OIG's model compliance guidance with respect to things like self-audit. And I'm always a big proponent. If you know, you listen on the podcast, I always talk about being I have a couple of catchphrases, right? Penny wise, pound foolish. You know, don't mm-hmm. save a little bit of money to not do audits from a third party to then have to pay back a lot of money or have to do a self-disclosure or a civil case. I find providers like to step over a dime to find a quarter that mm-hmm. doesn't exist by trying to cut some corners on things. But so we do a lot of the proactive work. If there is a self-disclosure to be made, we work a lot with providers and law firms on self-disclosures. A lot of litigation support, whether it be a QTAM type thing, response to a QTAM or working on an investigation, some criminal work. I do some work on the payer side. I have been retained by two PBMs as an expert, and I'm currently finishing up a project where I'm working for a blue. The PBMs were on some payment issues involving their fraud, waste, abuse on behalf of the PBMs. And on the blue, it's on a case involving a COVID lab and some issues involving price gouging. So I do a little bit of diversity on that. I also oversee all of our government contracts. We are a sub to a couple of government contracts in the fraud, waste, abuse space. And we do some work in the commercial space and this. So, you know, I handle most of that kind of work. But Advise as a company is very diverse. A lot of staff augmentation. So a lot of people that have sort of that subject matter expertise that are needed for projects either long term or short term. We're also the outsource to SIU for something now. I think it's about 10 or 12 different plans around the country where we have an analytics tool, a case management tool, and we do all of the things relating to the referral of cases back to the payer, all the way through to settlement negotiations and things of that sort for MCOs. We have an individual named Charlie Meyer who came from about a 20-year background, both in Mifuku and in the commercial MCO space. So, you know, pretty diverse group of people doing a pretty diverse thing. We try to only staff the company with real subject matter experts in some of these things. We've got two or three mm-hmm. other retired OIG people that I've recruited along the way. We've got some people with very strong Medicaid backgrounds that have been at state payers and the like. So, you know, we want to make sure that people get the kind of granular experience that are needed for some of the projects we work on.
Yeah. So you do some really exciting work. So my career, like early on, I was a corporate compliance officer for a large organization, and I was always fascinated with the compliance piece of it. And I was involved, you know, we had a situation, self-disclosure, been there, done that, when I was compliance officer, working with outside counsel, things of that nature. And I've done expert witness work now as a consultant. I feel I've kind of, my career, I don't know that I necessarily, I had a general idea of where I wanted my career to like go towards things that I just had like a natural inclination for. I would have thought I would have ended up probably like in compliance and staying in compliance, but just the way situations presented to me, I didn't continue to follow that direction because my first major goal was to become a corporate compliance officer. I mean, I achieved that at a very young age. I think I was 26 when I was a corporate compliance officer. And then just through circumstances, you know, life turns you in different directions that you don't expect. And you're looking for a job when you don't necessarily expect to be looking for a job and things of that nature. And you take a different path. But I feel like if I had to go back and do it all over again, I would pursue the compliance path, possibly. I was thinking about this yesterday, as a matter of fact. I was taking my afternoon walk and I'm reflecting, and, or was it, no, 2 days ago, because I was listening to your podcast at the same time, the Chuckleheads podcast. And I was thinking, if I could go back and do it all over again, I would probably jump into law school and become a healthcare attorney and do that, because it's still something that I find very interesting. And I like the compliance thing, but I've just kind of pigeonholed myself into this coding area. Don't get me wrong, it's lucrative and I enjoy it. But the best part of my job, when I do get to do the expert witness work, that is what I love the most. When I'm brought into those cases and you have to help the attorneys craft the arguments, whether it's defending the practice that the provider did, saying, oops, we did it accidentally, we didn't know, you know, those types of things, or you're defending the employer against the whistleblower, you know, situation from a disgruntled employee. I've been involved in those situations. So I've had a variety of that kind of work, which I really enjoyed. So I can relate to some of the things that you're saying, but again, I'm just fascinated by your career and like all that you've done. And I find it interesting. You started in corrections and then this is where you ended up all these years later.
I always joke that I started off by just being convicted. Then I went on probation. And now I'm out trying to find the, you know, the people, you know, then I went out and tried to find the people to put in jail. So, you know, I sort of had this path that went kind of the opposite way, but yeah, I was joked about, did my time, then I was on probation and now I got to investigate it. So, you know, look, it was a great career. I loved working at the OIG. It was a great career. I had a great time. I had great people I worked with. I had what I consider to be the best mentor that a person could have. I still remain very close friends with him. I've known him probably now 26 years. You know, he's as close to me as anybody in my life. I always say I wouldn't necessarily give him a kidney, but I would certainly think about it for a minute. But you know, it was a great place. I got to learn a lot. I was hired at a time when data analytics wasn't what it is today. I got hired at a time where when a case came to you, you didn't get to say, well, I don't want to work this. I don't know this. I don't understand this, and pass it on to someone else. Towards the end of my career, that was what was going on. You know, people got hired and they said, well, if it's not a Part D case, I'm not interested. If it's not this, I'm not interested. Mm-hmm. And I never got to do that. And a lot of the people in my era never got to do that. And I'm not saying that it made us smarter, but we definitely had a much better Rolodex of people to call on, but also we're not afraid to the challenge of sitting down and reading things and learning things. And that to me was where over time, I think there was a tectonic shift in the OIG from the investigative side, the Office of Investigation side, just because as the agency grew and the pool of applicants became very different, so did the ability to sort of have that real subject matter expertise that exists.
So what did you like most about working at OIG?
So for me, you know, what everybody has to understand is that the OIG is just sort of an umbrella organization. So for those that don't know granularly about it, there's the Office of Audit Services, there's the Office of Evaluation and Inspections, and there's the Office of Investigations. And we can spend an hour talking about what each one of those components do and what it is. So I worked for the Office of Investigations. I was the badge and gun. And what I do in a lot of I do a ton of presentations about this, and I have to kind of demystify and debunk, and we can do that another time. But, you know, I was the law enforcement part of it, the criminal investigator. So I did criminal, civil, administrative cases. And to me, the most fun and the most interesting part was that you were really putting the puzzle together and in some regards, trying to prove that the people on this planet who sometimes have the hubris to think that they are the smartest people in the world really aren't. You know, I had one of my very first cases as an agent involved an ophthalmologist on Staten Island who was, you know, number one at Duke in medical school. I think his undergraduate was Columbia. Smart guy, you know, and the going joke is what do you call the guy or gal that graduates first from medical school, doctor? What do you call the guy or gal that graduates last, doctor? This guy was very smart, right? Mm-hmm. Columbia, Duke, and he committed an $8 million fraud at a time when $8 million frauds were unheard of. It was a very large case at the time. And there was something very satisfying as one of my first cases to not only have that be the, you know, it was a criminal and a civil resolution, but there were some patient harm issues. There was some services not rendered, medically necessary services, things of that sort. But the greatest part was sort of the hunt of the challenge of that this person thinks that they're going to get away with it and they're not hiding the fact that they're doing it.
Yeah, I always find that fact. I mean, I've worked with a lot of providers and I've seen a lot of things. And I think a lot of people do things out of ignorance. I mean, that's what I find. It's not intentional in a lot of cases. But what I find interesting is sometimes when you bring things to the attention of providers, they're like, oh, well, okay, I just won't do it anymore. And they don't want to do anything about what they've already done. And that's something that's like always kind of, you know, bothered me there. And I'm like, well, now that you're aware of it, you have a bigger problem than if you had gone unaware of it. And I don't think that they quite understand that. And you mentioned earlier, you know, about being proactive. One thing I found is that a lot of providers are not proactive. I work with providers after they're already dealing with a situation where they're being looked at, you know, they're being audited and money's being taken back and some things are being looked at for potential, you know, fraud and abuse. And I tell them, I'm like, if you had spent some money up front, you could have really avoided a lot of headaches if you had someone in here doing audits, you know, of your coding, of your documentation. If you had a compliance plan, a lot of people still don't have a compliance plan in place. It's like, what's that, a compliance plan? And again, you say it's about saving money. They don't want to spend the money, but in the long run, I feel that that auditing and that solid compliance plan actually benefits you. You can possibly become more profitable because of it. Let's face it. When we're doing compliance, we're looking at both sides of it. Maybe you're right. Missing out on things, you right. know, that you should legitimately be billing and there's something that can be fixed. And so I've always found them to be very short-sighted, particularly with physicians. What I've noticed in all the years working with them is they never look at anything until the revenue stream, something happens. There's like a hiccup there and we're not collecting the money that we're supposed to. What's going on? And then they're scrambling and they're looking for a solution. But as long as they're making the amount of money that they feel they should be making and it's pretty steady, they don't really question anything. That's when I would go in and do consulting and physician practices and talk to the people over the billing operation, and I would ask them questions, basic questions, even something as simple as how many denials a month, you know, do you get? I don't know. I'm like, really? I'm like, you can't even quantify stuff like that. And I'm like, the physicians are completely unaware of the business side of things. And so I think sometimes, and you know, maybe you can comment on this from your experience when you're doing investigations, how often did you find that it was a staff person who caused an issue and not the provider themselves? Yeah. And the provider got caught up in something staff was doing because they were unaware.
Well, you know, so you bring up a good point. You talked about fraud and abuse and there's a waste issue there. And, you know, I think when we're talking about things on the payer side, there's SIUs and there's payment integrity and they will treat them differently. The SIU is really the fraud, the waste abuse are those issues in which there's an abuse of the program. And, you know, I think that for providers who are intent on committing fraud, they really don't care what Eric Rubenstein has to say. Right. They certainly don't care what Stacey Buck has to say. Because people that are intent on committing fraud just want to make the money and get out. They don't really care. Mm-hmm. So we're really talking about the waste abuse people where it's a little bit of a combination of the two. At the OIG, we really didn't discern waste, fraud, and abuse separately. It really came down to when the U.S. Attorney's Office made a charging decision about whether or not it was going to be a criminal case or a civil case, or even if they were going to decline the case entirely and it was going to go to the Office of Counsel, to the Inspector General, OSIG, for something like a civil monetary penalties case, a CMP administrative case. So that's really how, you know, at the end of the day, the ability to discern whether something is going to be a criminal case versus something else. But getting, you know, moving on to, well, you know, who are the complicit parties in something where how often is it something other than the doctor? So the first instance that I ever came across with a billing management type person who was complicit in a case was my very first trial, which was in 2002, involving a company that is now well defunct called Jamaica Foot Care, or was Citywide Foot Care. It was about a $20 million podiatry case. This was my first podiatry case. It was definitely not my last. For whatever reason, I did probably 12 or 13 criminal podiatry cases in my career. I knew more about, I know way more about podiatry than I should know. And I would always tell new agents that if they were looking for a case, let's run some data and I will find you a podiatry case, because the fraud patterns typically are very similar when you're talking about traditional podiatry violations of some of the 60-day rules and things like that. But that case had, it was about 20 providers, $20 or $30 million in fraud. I can talk for hours about every fraud they committed that you can think of, they committed. And the trial wound up being delayed substantially because of something that occurred on September 11th, which resulted in some delays going on there, which are entirely other stories you could talk about. But ultimately, four people went on trial. Three were podiatrists, and one was the billing manager. And she was a co-conspirator in this. And the way that they did their fraudulent billing, she was a, you know, part and parcel of that. That was my first sort of foray into seeing that. Typically, the billers, you know, we'll call them billers because there's obviously a difference between a biller, a coder, and an auditor. And I always discern very different. Right. There's a difference I see in my head between someone who's a coder and an auditor. People that are billers are really just doing the mechanical process of data entry and putting information in place. You know, I had a project that I did for Advise with an ophthalmologist who had five locations all around the five boroughs of New York. He owned the buildings in most of the locations. He considered himself a mom and pop business, although he had offices that were open 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. I don't understand how he was able to characterize himself as that. And when I asked him who did his coding, he said, well, I have, as you know, now is the most offensive thing, my girls in the back. And I showed him, I showed him a super bill and I said, well, who's circling these CPT codes? And he said, well, I am, or my, you know, the other doctors are, the other practitioners are. And I said, well, what are your girls in the back doing? And he said, well, they just, you know, they're typing in the information. They're doing the coding. And I said, well, no, no, they're doing the mechanical data entry. You're doing the coding. He said, I'm not doing the coding. I'm just circling the things that I do. And I said, no, no, no. You're circling the things that you think you're doing. What does your documentation say? Like there's, you know, so you have to get to these granular conversations, but it, you know, I think that it depends upon who the biller coder is. One of the more famous cases that came out in the past number of years, the first CMP case that was done on a biller slash coder, it was a woman named Susan Toy. Her company was Millennium Billing and Coding, and she worked for a doctor named Labib Riachi. I only know that because I worked on that case in New Jersey. And she was a 1099 contractor, so she had her own billing coding company. And, you know, but she was part and parcel to the fraud. She was, you know, they had a drop down menu. Whenever the patient came in for one thing, it billed five things. I think oftentimes it really is dependent upon who the person is, what their role is, and what their real level of knowledge is. I've had cases where I had one in particular with a podiatrist who he knew the codes very, very well. He knew all of the podiatric debridement codes very well, and he understood that in order to get paid for services, he had to find a way to circumvent the 61-day rule or the 60-day rule, so anything over 60 days in podiatry. And he was very good at understanding that. And what he would do is he would render the services that he rendered on his patients whenever he rendered them, and he would provide post-it notes to his biller on what to bill on what day for what code, so that he can intentionally circumvent the coding. So, you know, I think, and I have some PowerPoints I do where I talk about the fact that people that are on the coding side and the billing side, that they can be part and parcel to the fraud scheme, whether it be criminally, if you can prove the intent from a criminal perspective, but even knew or should have known, you know, hey, you may not be getting any specific information about this, but if this doesn't pass your stink test, your internal stink test, and you should be questioning it, are you in a position where you can question it? Is there some person you can complain to? What's the provider saying? You know, how do you put that on record? And if you are at risk of losing your job for putting it on record, which is the worst of the two things? Losing your job for putting it on the record and then maybe doing something proactively as a result of that, or being part and parcel to a fraud and then having your name, your reputation, and your livelihood besmirched for the rest of your, you know, professional career.
Yeah, that's something that I see come up frequently in a lot of social media discussion forums where you have coders that are working for a provider and the coders have shared concerns about coding practices, billing practices, yeah. and they push back on it and they're seeking advice and they're asking about what they should do. And I find it very interesting that everybody is like, oh, you need to like, you know, do a KTAM, you need to do a whistleblower, you need to, and I'm like, whoa, I'm like, come on. I'm like, we're kind of missing some steps here. And right. as you know, there are some huge ramifications to doing something like that. You know, people have to think about, you know, their jobs, their livelihood. There are like other steps in between. So if somebody came to you and they said, you kind of touched on it a little bit, what is the series of steps that you would tell them yeah. to follow when they find themselves in that situation?
Yeah. And we've had that happen. You know, I've done a number of talks at some of the local AAPC chapters in person. I've done a bunch of virtual. And I remember particularly I was at one at the New York City chapter, which is a pretty widely attended, you know, meeting. Mm-hmm. And somebody raised their hand and said, I work for this practice. They're committing fraud. I've gone to the, you know, compliance person. I've gone to the, like, they went through their litany and they're like, and no one wants to do anything. And, you know, the person's like, I feel like I'm a rock in a hard place because I really need this job. They pay me well. Mm-hmm. You know, do they pay, you know, the glass is not half full to me. You know, Murphy was an optimist. And I always say in the compliance world, I always say in a world of no, I like to be more no, because you have to take that step back. And you have to think about things. And so if you're paying somebody really well and you're telling someone that they're committing fraud, why are they paying you that well? And I think it's a mm-hmm. concern. There are a lot of people who mm-hmm. are doing this work and say, hey, you know, what's the thing? So the first thing to do is obviously go to whoever your primary point of contact is. If you have a compliance officer, if you're a practice that has a compliance officer, and first and foremost, if they have an anonymous way to do it, the first thing I would do is at least do it anonymously, because what you don't mm-hmm. want to do is then put the you don't want to put the red herring on you that, you know, all right. I'm opening up this door and I'm creating this problem. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have the scarlet letter on you. You don't want to be that person. So the very first thing is to document that you are aware of this problem and make your complaint and do it in writing so that you have it date and time stamped. And the thing that I say is most important is the level of detail and granularity has to be there. You cannot just mm-hmm. make a complaint and make mm-hmm. it this anonymous complaint with no information. And we could talk about how in the OIG world, those complaints are very rarely ever acted upon, because an anonymous complaint with no detail is nothing more than someone who is angry and complaining. And you have right. to be able to have some information to vet it out. So that's your first step. If there is no compliance officer, if there's a way to make someone aware of it in writing anonymously, that's how I would start. And if it means something like writing your complaint in, you know, writing it out in a letter and then mailing it and doing it in a way where you mail it from a different post office or some way to protect your identity, but you've got to at least put somebody on notice that you've identified this as a problem and mm-hmm. tried to take some steps to at least say, hey, because you don't know, is this intentional? Is this an accident? Right. Is this just that someone doesn't know? I think before you get to that point of making that complaint, it's obviously incumbent upon you to say, hey, I have noticed that this is happening. I think that this is a problem. Here's why I think it's a problem. And here's what I think is the solution, right? So-and-so is billing this code and it appears from the documentation it's wrong. Here's why it's wrong. Here's the NCD that's why it says it's wrong. Here's the LCD that says why it's wrong. Here's how we fix it and then move on from there. And if there's still been no traction from that, and there's still been no traction from making your complaint anonymously, and you are in fear of retribution, that this is going to get you into a pickle with your employer and you may lose your job, then I think the next step is internally documenting instances when you've made this known to people, when you've seen this as a problem, documenting instances where you've identified it as a problem, where you've made the suggestions, creating that paper trail of where you saw these as problems and where you saw these steps that needed to be taken to rectify it. And be specific. You know, on such and such a date, you reviewed patient record this. This was billed. Mm-hmm. It was documented this way. this is why it is wrong. You know, you've got to have that granularity. Some other steps you can take, you can clearly go to the OIG 1-800-HHS-TIPS, which is the tip line. You will get an analyst on the phone. You can do it in writing. You can send it on their website. I can tell you with 100% certainty, every single HHS TIPS hotline complaint that comes in gets looked at. Now, it may not get looked at to the level of an agent. It may get looked at the level of an analyst, but there are no instances that I'm ever aware of when I was there where a complaint came in and it was just tossed aside. It's reviewed. It's at least vetted for what's in it. You know, for what's the meat on the bones. But with that being said, if a complaint comes in from anonymous with no way to contact the person and Dr. Jones is committing healthcare fraud, look into this. That the vetting process for that is nothing.
Right.
Right. Because what do you do with that? You can't act on everything. But some of I've had a number of cases that came to actual criminal fruition as the result of very good granular level complaints that came into the OIG hotline, where people said, I am so-and-so, this is where I'm working, this is the fraud, here's what's going on, where there's documents attached, there's everything. And so you have to be willing to, you know, take that step and be in a position to be able to say, this is fraud, I'm taking a stand, and vet it out through the HHS tips line. Now, the last piece, which is what, you know, you sort of touched upon, which is KETAMs, which are known as whistleblower complaints, which are filed by relators, which are known as the whistleblowers, are people who come in and they file a lawsuit with an attorney on behalf of the government seeking to be financially compensated for reporting a fraud, waste, or abuse issue. And people are obviously entitled to do that. As an OIG agent, I would never encourage people to do that because that's just not what my job was to do. But there are instances where it is really an appropriate method to do that. And those are typically, you know, you're not making a complaint to the HHS tips line. You're being able to really document substantially times, people, places, and things that are supportive and indicia of a fraud, waste, abuse issue. And, you know, as you see from reading, if you read the press releases and things that are out there, KETAMs result in very, very large amounts of money in many cases. And those very large amounts of money spill down to the whistleblowers. A whistleblower can get between 15 and 25% of recovered money if the government intervenes. If the government doesn't intervene, a whistleblower can still pursue it and can recoup as much as 30% of the recovered amounts. And when you see some of these cases result in hundreds of millions of dollars in settlements, and so whistleblowers are essentially, you know, getting, could be paid tens of millions of dollars for identifying that fraud, waste, abuse, and being able to point the government in a direction for something that they wouldn't have otherwise known about.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people think about that. I've heard people casually talk about, you know, oh, well, if you're the whistleblower, you could even get millions of dollars like down the road. Well, that's not exactly an easy thing to do. I mean, whatever you're, I think people see something in front of them and they might feel that this rises to that level, that's you right. know, of like fraud, and it's like really serious. And right. I think they're overestimating what they have, and they think that going down this path is a smart path. And you can go to an attorney, and you know, there are attorneys out there who will take anybody for any reason. You can find somebody who will take your case and bring it forward. And I'm like, you have to ask yourself, like, are you just looking at this as like a get rich quick thing? Because it's not. Because I know you've worked on these cases. How many years does it take for these cases to actually work their way through? It's a very, yeah, very long time. Yeah.
So, you know, it depends on so there's a couple of factors. And so the thing that I talk a lot about, you know, I blog incessantly on LinkedIn. I talk a lot about things on LinkedIn about press releases, and oftentimes people will respond back about, you know, well, it took long enough, because you'll see a case could take 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. COVID put a very big wrinkle, and I don't want to say, you know, I think a lot of people have blamed COVID for a lot of things, the least of which is their own laziness, because they feel like, you know, they can be, but in a lot of instances, cases slowed down because the courts closed for the most part. Right. Grand juries were put on hold. But depending upon the district that you're in and the priorities of that district are really going to drive how long a case is. There are 14 or 15 strike force cities around the country. Strike force cases tend to move a little bit faster because you've got a couple of prosecutors that are absolutely dedicated to those cases. There's a lot of resources that are put into those. And the strike force model, when it started, was essentially a low-hanging fruit model. It started in Miami. Excuse me. It started in Miami where they were going after providers in which, you know, the address was a dirt lot. Those are pretty straightforward cases. And, you know, there isn't a provider there. But, you know, as the strike force moved forward into different cities, when it went into Brooklyn, the criminal element in Brooklyn was not the same criminal element that it was in Miami. The criminal element in Brooklyn, actual buildings, actual services rendered with providers where the patients were now complicit in the fraud. And so the cases can take a long time depending upon the complexity. When we start talking about the cases that result in QI-TAMs being filed, those are not low-hanging fruit cases many of the time. Those are cases that require deep, complex analyses of the fraud. There's typically years worth of documents that are reviewed. There are typically many meetings with the relator. And so a QI-TAM could take 2, 3, 4 years. A lot of the cases that I worked on were 2 years to 4 years to resolution. I think the problem that I often have with people that opine in the absence of having actual knowledge versus their topical knowledge of what they read. Unfortunately, a lot of people are keyboard warriors. And I love the LinkedIn community of the people who really understand these things. Is there are a lot of people who read the press releases and have a lot of opinions, but what they don't realize is that the press release is only the information that is publicly being disclosed. There's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes that you never know about. For example, you know, without giving up the store, if you've got a case that resulted in there being cooperating witnesses, debriefing cooperating witnesses takes a very long time. If cooperating witnesses are out making recordings on behalf of the investigation as a government witness, and they're doing on a kickback case, they are recording conversations with potentially people who are targets of the investigation. That takes a very long time to do because you need to show the pattern. You want to have multiple recordings. Those take a very long time. You know, I had a very large MRI kickback case. There were 15 criminal defendants, 17 originally, or 18 criminal defendants, 14 of them were charged. We were doing 3 and 4 recordings with each one of those defendants every month, trying to get 14 or 15 or 16 recordings in a month takes a very it's a lot of time to do that. You have to download the recordings. You have to listen to them. You have to transcribe them. Looking at bank records takes a very long time. You don't just serve a subpoena on a bank and 3 days later get the records.
Right.
Getting documentation from a UPIC on a Medicare fraud investigation takes time. Getting records reviewed. If I would do a search warrant, you know, the preparation work for a search warrant is enormous. People don't realize the difficulties in getting search warrants. It's not just, hey, let's do one and we go do it. So there's a lot of time that comes into that. So, you know, you've got that. On a QI-TAM, you're constantly speaking to the relator because the relator is giving you pieces of the puzzle and you're helping to put pieces of the puzzle together. And people need to really think about that, you know, like while you're working at the practice, are you a whistleblower while you're working at that practice, or have you lost your job and are you now a whistleblower and what are you doing? And, you know, the reality is that if your name gets out there as a whistleblower and that case does not come to fruition with a result because the U.S. attorneys may investigate it and then decline it. And the U.S. attorneys may, you know, there may be an investigation that goes on for a year or two. And then it gets declined. And then, you know, so yeah, there are some very, very strong pieces of information that you have to think about internally about whether this is the path that you wish to take and have the right people in front of you. Lawyers that do this are typically the ones that do QI-TAMs a lot are very good at vetting these things out and understanding this because the lawyers also realize that there's a pot of money at the end of the mm-hmm. process, but they're mm-hmm. investing a lot of time, money, effort, and resources that they are not being paid for up front. And so, you know, there's a lot of investment on those cases as well. And so you have to make sure that you're going to the right lawyer for the right thing. The fact that a lawyer does KETAMs and whistleblower cases doesn't mean that they can do healthcare KETAMs and whistleblower cases.
Right. Yeah. I've seen working as an expert witness with attorneys in the healthcare space, when you're working on behalf of the provider, when you're dealing with opposing counsel on the other side, I'm like, what are these people even doing? They don't even know what they're talking about. Like, they don't belong in this space. Like I said, anybody can find an attorney to take their case and move forward.
Yeah.
You know, which is unfortunate. And so I feel that people who look at this is like I said, they get rich quick, or, you know, I can make mm-hmm. not necessarily, like you say, the case may not actually, you know, work its way through. You may never see, you know, a dime from anything that you've done. So then what do you do? You need to make sure that you have that solid case, because you are putting your career on the line. I mean, if you bring, you know, forth something like this and it doesn't go anywhere, who's going to want to hire you in the field if that has occurred? And one case that I was involved in, like, you know, people who get fired and then they try to do something. This was a while back. I worked with a provider where the employee got let go. And then after she let go, now she decides she wants wrongful termination. And she's also wants to be a whistleblower and say that they were committing fraud. There was one particular type of exam that they were billing incorrectly. And so they brought me in to look at that. And it was complete garbage. It was one of those gray areas in coding. It was a minimal amount of exams. There was not even any money attached to it in the grand scheme of things. And I'm like, again, the attorney working it clearly has no idea how this works and thinks that they can tag this on and do something with it. And anyway, they ended up settling with the employee because it was more the wrongful termination than anything else to just leave her, you know, go away at that point. The coding part of it never went anywhere. It never should have been brought to begin with at all.
Well, you bring up the good point that you bring up is that, and I'd seen this many, many times where a KETAM gets filed and they tack on a complaint of wrongful termination based upon discrimination or age or whistleblower protection. And then what happens is the KETAM is really garbage. The complaint is really unfounded. And so what happens is the lawyers will then go and dismiss all of the counts of the complaint minus the age discrimination, wrongful termination, or what have you, so that they can keep the complaint in federal court. Yeah, it's sort of a common thing. But, you know, the point of that is that when you've got a lawyer, and this would be common in the criminal sense, we would have a criminal defense lawyer come into the U.S. Attorney's Office for a show and tell, or what they call a reverse proffer. Where there's a conversation and the lawyer may be some really, really well-known criminal defense lawyer in the area, but knows nothing about healthcare. Mm-hmm. And so you're spending your day having a Groundhog Day situation. Like every day you're meeting with the defense lawyer, you're having to explain to them, okay, this is a CPT code. This is an ICD-10 code.
Right.
This is a HCPCS code. By the way, a HCPCS code, it's like a CPT code, but it's only for certain things. And it doesn't have four numbers. It's a letter and four. You know, and I go, you know, here, this is coming from the world's okayest coder, which I'm not. But, you know, sitting and explaining this to a defense lawyer, you know, you kind of have this Groundhog Day. And I would have that with AUSAs, you know, prosecutors who were getting into the healthcare unit. And I was always okay doing that with a prosecutor who was coming into the healthcare unit, or some healthcare lawyer who was now getting into something new, because they were in it. They understood. I didn't have to explain to them what a CPT code was. I may have to say, okay, this is what the fraud is as it relates to it. But, you know, it really is. If you're not in front of the right audience, then, you know, it becomes an issue. And the, you know, the government takes the position that they do not look to charge an individual if they don't think that they can win the case, right? The U.S. Attorney's Office isn't charging someone criminally. They are not filing a civil complaint against someone civilly if they don't think that they have the ability to win that case. And they may not win on all the counts, but they have a reasonable assumption that they're going to. And it's the same thing when you go to trial and you're picking a jury. You're looking to pick a jury that you think is going to be on your side.
Mm-hmm.
And that you've got a case that you're going to be able to explain the fraud to, right? Because part of jury appeal is what is the complexity of the case? Is this case so complicated that a jury is not going to understand it? Or more importantly, is this so complex that even I'm not going to be able to explain, you know, that a prosecutor is not going to be able to explain it to a jury? You know, I had that. I had eight or nine trials in my career, which is a lot. And I was in a non-strike force city. So that was a lot. And one of them was, it was the first False Claims Act trial in the District of New Jersey that anybody could remember in the past like 30 years. And it was a stark issue. And the three civil AUSAs, it was a civil case, the three AUSAs were all getting ready to leave the U.S. Attorney's Office. None of them had tried a civil case and all wanted trial experience. And so, you know, you can actually see the train coming. It's coming at full speed on that because you're like, how is this going to be great? Because it's a False Claims Act trial on Stark, which nobody understands Stark.
Right.
People that know Stark don't understand. Very complicated.
When I was a compliance officer, that was my biggest headache, you're was like, oh, Stark, to wrap my brain around that.
And, you know, I've got three AUSAs who say to me when it's trial prep time, no, we don't need you. We're okay. And in the criminal, in criminal trials, the case agent is as intrinsically involved with trial prep as you can imagine. Trial prep is people who don't understand this could never understand it. Trial prep is brutal. It's 7 days a week for 12 and 14 hours a day for months on end until the trial is over. And while the trial is going on, it's 8 days a week, 25 hours a day, because you're there at the beck and call of your prosecutors. And, you know, this was a very complicated issue. It was three AUSAs who had not ever tried a case in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And it's complicated. And we lost that trial. And I say, looking back now, rightfully so, there were pieces of evidence that we should have presented that we didn't present. The number one thing in the Stark and the self-referral is, what was the provider's billing pattern before the arrangement? What was their billing pattern after? No different than a criminal anti-kickback statute to an extent.
Right.
You know, that wasn't presented at trial. There were some other faux pas that went on. But, you know, a little bit of it is, who's your audience when you're presenting it? You know,
right.
And as a whistleblower, are you finding the right audience to explain it? Is the lawyer you're bringing on that right audience? Because these are oftentimes, particularly in a complex case with a whistleblower, these are complicated issues. If you're talking about something in the office setting and a provider is manipulating a test, an item, or a procedure, you know, those could be very complicated issues. You know, how are they doing this? How is it that when they use this modifier, it gets paid versus not? As a coder, auditor, these are very important considerations that you have to make. I think that anybody who files a QI-TAM who truly believes that there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow needs to really understand that that may be the case, but there also may not be a pot of gold. And more importantly, that the pot of gold may be $100,000 and not $100 million.
Right, exactly.
And is $100,000 worth what you're going to be doing?
Exactly. You have to figure, I look at things this way. It's like, is it worth my time, effort, the stress, the emotional, you know, stress, having to deal with something, go through that process? It's like, what is the payoff? I'm like, I want to be assured that there's going to be millions of dollars if I'm going to personally put myself through that, because it's not going to be easy on that person. If they think that's going to be easy, when, you know, it comes down to a trial situation and they're being hammered by the opposite side, that's not fun. I've sat in depositions and they hammer at you and hammer at you and like trying to like crack you. And it's one of those things, you have to have that tough skin and just stick to your guns and repeat. And not everybody can stand up against that. I believe that's very difficult when you have opposing counsel going at you. It's not as easy as it would seem.
Listen,
because they try to get you to twist your words and change your words and change what you're saying. And I always tell people, if you're in that situation, say as little as possible. Answer the question. Yes, no. Don't expand on anything at all. Keep it to like a minimum.
Depositions are terrible in general. Because there's nobody there to be referee like a judge. I've had a couple of depositions over Zoom with COVID. I had an arbitration over Zoom, so that wasn't as bad. But you know, the one deposition I had over Zoom, the opposing counsel like threw his glasses at the screen at me as if that was, and listen, you know, I was a trial agent for years, and I was called in one of my last trials. I was actually called as a witness by the defense, which was just sort of unbelievable that that would happen, you know, that a defense attorney would call the case agent on a case who knows every fact of the case, but mm-hmm. to be called as a witness, you know, because typically the government doesn't call the case agent as the witness because I do know all the answers. And so they want to have somebody who can really just answer the questions that the U.S. Attorney's Office has to pose, you know, mm-hmm. to them. But I have all the answers as the case agent. And the defense attorney in one of my last trials called me as a witness, which was mind boggling. But yeah, you know, these are all things that you really, you know, that are very strong considerations when you're doing these things. And the process and having to, you know, meet with me when I need to meet with you because there's something going on. And you know, when you're a relator in a case, it's you're in for a dime, you're in for a dollar. You know, if you're still working there, there may be instances where we need you to have conversation, you know, agents need you to have conversations mm-hmm. with people, mm-hmm. you know, and all of that. So yeah, there are a lot of challenges. I think, you know, when you're looking to do this, you're looking to do this to do the right thing.
Right.
I would always love when I would sit across the table from relators in the meeting. So we would always get the complaint. We always get all the documents, and then we would set up a meeting. U.S. Attorney's Office would have a criminal AUSA, a civil AUSA, all of the agencies that might be involved. So it'd be, you know, typically us. If other agencies were involved where there was some commercial pay, maybe, you know, it's Department of Defense IG, so DCIS, Defense Criminal Investigative Service, you know, some of our other law enforcement partners. And then the whistleblower would come in and their lawyers would come in. And my favorites were always the pharma ones, the off-label, the kickbacks were always mm-hmm. my favorite ones because those were sales reps who, until they got fired, a lot of times the fraud was okay. Like, you right. know, mm-hmm. sending in their monthly invoices for their expense reports for the 27 dinners that they had or, you know, whatever it would be. And I would always sit across and I was never a popular guy with these cases. But, because I would always ask the question, let me get this straight. While you were working there, this was okay. But when you got fired, it wasn't okay. And it would often prompt, and I didn't do it, you know, to be frank, as a New Yorker, I didn't do it to be an asshole. I did it because I wanted to ensure that if this person was reporting what was going on, we understood that from the beginning. Like I wanted this person to kind of get defensive and take a stance and say, no, it wasn't okay. I reported it and here's emails and here's conversations. It was never my intent. And I would always explain it afterwards. My intention wasn't to elicit someone to think I was being an asshole intentionally. I mean, I may have been an asshole, but it was but it was really for the purposes of me understanding, because sometimes some of the granular facts that someone knows, maybe they forget. Maybe it's not imparted in the complaint, in the disclosure. Mm-hmm. And so I would say, you know, I would always ask, so I just want to understand this, that while you were working there and you were submitting this document or that document or going to these meetings, it was okay, but once you were getting fired or being disgruntled, then it wasn't okay. And I would get this like, whoa, 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 very heavy pushback from everybody in the room. And then once the person would explain why it wasn't okay, I would kind of look around and I would say, I'm really not an asshole. I just need to get the answer. And that was the best way to get the answer. There was one relator that I had who actually said yes. And I filed this QITAM because I was pissed off I didn't get promoted. And we would have never gotten that answer had I not mm-hmm. asked that question. There was someone who literally was, they were an older guy. They were in charge of a division that was trying to do some workarounds to a device that had been rejected by the FDA under its, what they call the 510K. And he saw this and he was like, whoa. And when they passed him up for a promotion, he then made a stink about it. And then ultimately he filed his QITAM and he said it. And he was very matter of fact. I was angry. I thought I should have gotten this promotion. They didn't give it to me. I think they didn't give it to me because I'm a 60-year-old white man, and I was pissed off and mad about it. We would have never gotten that response from him had I not given some, you know, kind of, you know, really point blank question. But, right. you know, I think when whistleblowers are ready, whistleblowers have to be ready to be questioned in a manner that isn't puppies and kittens.
Correct. Absolutely. And so again, I think people oversimplify it when they're just talking and your coder is talking. It's kind of like that fantasy, like, well, I'm not going to win the lottery. Maybe there's another way to like, you know, achieve this. And I'm like, it's not as easy as you would think. So I always tell people, you need to think long and hard about what you're doing. And then you gave some great steps on how people should document. So if you're in a situation, like I know what sometimes will happen is somebody's working for an employer and they're documenting. Then they leave the employer, okay? So how should they handle that situation? Because now you're probably in a situation where you want to take information with you, documentation with you. There's information there that probably shouldn't be, like how did, there's probably patient information, you know, HIPAA concerns. So if you're covering yourself on the way out the door, because something could happen after you leave and then you need to be able to defend yourself and have the proof. What is the best way to handle that?
Yeah, that's a great, it's a really tough question to answer. So number one, if you're actively working with law enforcement on something, whether it's you file the QITAM as a relator or you're just a cooperating witness, the one thing that the government should never ask you to do, and I'm not saying that people haven't, but one thing that the government should never ask you to do, one thing that I would have never asked a witness to do, is to go and take documents while they're a cooperating witness for the government. Because essentially what you're doing is you're having that person serve as a workaround for the government. And there's a very big thing called the Bill of Rights, and there's a Fourth Amendment issue. And, you know, you've got a huge issue with working the workaround. I mean, one of the reasons that search warrants exist is because they are a impetus for law enforcement to have a lawful way to conduct a search and seizure, which is the Fourth Amendment. And so, you know, if I've got you, you're working for a practice and you're cooperating with me and you're assisting me as a witness and informant or what have you, there's no way on God's green earth I should be asking you to start taking things. It's really bad. It's really bad. And those documents would never, you'd have a very hard time getting those documents allowed in by the court, even if it was an actual smoking gun document to do that. That being said, if a private citizen is looking to take documents on their own, and it, you know, as law enforcement, if I've made it perfectly clear, I'm not instructing you in any way, shape, or form to take documents. What you do is on you. I'm not instructing you. I'm not advising you. That would sort of be the caveat, or you know, what you would say is, hey, look, this is on you entirely. And sometimes even a written admonishment, you know, that as a cooperating witness, you're not being instructed to take anything. You're not being instructed to make recordings without approval or anything like that. But if you're like a private citizen, and I think this is where it gets kind of sticky, you know.
Now, what if you're in a situation where you're not working as a witness, just the employee who's leaving, and you're like, and you've followed, you know, the internal protocol, right. And you're like, I've had enough, I can't work here anymore. How are you covering yourself once you leave? Like, what can you take? What should you not take? How do you handle that?
Yeah, and a little bit of this is a legal discussion about what is your fiduciary responsibility? Do you have ownership responsibility? Do you not? You know, like sort of the line that's drawn about, and because I think what you're really saying, Stacey, if I read between the lines, is I don't want to have the finger pointed at me.
Correct.
Right. So that's really what it comes down to. And I think that that's a challenge that you need to be able to be in a position to protect your integrity as a person, as an employee, as someone who said, hey, you know, I am documenting this. And I've seen this many times where people are sending an email to the compliance officer and they blind copy themselves. Right. So they have a record of it, because if it disappears, it doesn't disappear from you. Or a screenshot of what you just emailed or something along those lines, you know, and I think that, you know, as a private person, you're, you know, keeping a record of these things and you're documenting what you think to be problematic things. Where you may run into a snag is if you were looking to do an audio recording. You know, now everybody whips out their phone and records mm-hmm. conversations. So some mm-hmm. states are single party consent states and some states are dual party consent. Meaning if we're in, so when I'm sitting in my apartment that I have in New Jersey and I want to record a conversation with someone and not tell them. So I want to have a conversation with you, Stacy, about your criminal activity or your fraud. And I'm in my place in New Jersey. New Jersey is a one-party consent state. I can record that conversation and not tell you. I'm consenting to that recording because I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. When I'm sitting in my house in Florida, which is where I am right now, Florida is a two-party consent state, which means that if I'm going to have a conversation with you and I'm going to record that conversation, I have to tell you, hey, Stacy, by the way, I'm recording this conversation because I'm in the state which requires that. So you have to be very cautious. Now, where that becomes a bit of an issue is that if, well, criminally, you've committed a problem, right? So I've got that on as a recording. Mm-hmm. But, you know, can the mm-hmm. defendant who's made those what they call inculpatory statements from a state statute perspective, could you be held liable as the person who recorded it from a state? There's a civil liability attached to that. You know, how does that ultimately affect what happens criminally? I'm not really sure. But you could be held liable civilly for violating the, you know, what they essentially, you know, it's like a wiretapping type law. But I think that if you're in a position where, hey, look, you've tried to do the right thing, you've gone to the right parties, you're documenting what you're doing. I mean, I think you've got to at least keep track of those in some way, shape, or form. Now, I'm not suggesting that you start taking patient records, photocopying Correct. Them, right? You've got some HIPAA issues.
But you may
that.
Have had in your communications, there could have been patient information in your communications referring to specific patients or specific accounts or something like that. So that's kind of what I'm talking about, like the sensitivity of stuff like that, then yeah. leaving the building and being with you.
Yeah. So, I mean, the issue is if you're going to email something, like, you know, if I'm going to email the compliance officer of my practice and say, I think that there's a problem with code 1000. And as an example, patient account ABC had this done. I think that if you couch the way that you do it, so if you were to say patient mm-hmm. account 1000 had CPT, patient account ABC had CPT 1000 on April 13th, have you violated HIPAA? Right? You've not disclosed any mm-hmm. patient information in that sense. And so I think that you have to think a little tactically that if you're trying to protect yourself from being looped in to this, the, you know, for the viewers, the finger pointing, put your 3D
He's pointing
glasses
his finger.
On, put your 3D glasses on. But I think that that's mm-hmm. something that is right. So if you've got to think a little bit in today's world, you have to think a little strategically, right? If you're going to report something and you need to keep a record of it, you have to think strategically about how you're reporting it. And if you mm-hmm. think that you have to protect yourself in some way down the road, does protecting yourself mean that when I send that email to the compliance officer, I am not saying patient Stacy Buck had CPT code 1000 on this day for an EKG, which I know is 93,000, not 1000.
Mm-hmm. Very good. World's okayest right? medical coder.
I know, it's not bad, right? Not bad. So if you're going to take it to that level of granularity, then you have to be careful about emailing that to your Yahoo account, right? Mm-hmm. Or your Gmail account that you're doing that. But if you are looking to do something where you're really looking to create some level of protection for you, because if you are I fathom a guess that if you are reporting this to somebody in compliance, there's a pattern that has existed that you've now obviously come to a point where you're identifying it. This isn't a one-off, right? If you're mm-hmm. if you're raising this to the level mm-hmm. of concern to a compliance officer, you're doing it as such because it's risen to the level of, hey, I'm noticing this now. And so maybe it's come to the point where when you send that email, you can send that email and you can say, I noticed a problem with CPT code 1000. And by the way, it's for the following patients, ID, patient ID this, patient ID that, and then you've not violated HIPAA when you send that to your, when you CC it to your Gmail account, right? Because you've provided no patient identification, right? I mean, one of the, you know, one of the keys is to not disclose patient information, PHI or PII. And so, you know, that's a way to protect you. I'm working on something now where we cannot believe it, but the assistant U.S. attorney posted in PACER. So for those that don't know, PACER is the repository of publicly filed documents in federal cases. Sometimes the document is sealed and there's just a document that says sealed. In other instances, it's a public document. I just got alerted the other day of an AUSA on a criminal case, an indicted individual. The AUSA posted to PACER a letter that includes patient names and dates of service. Publicly filed. By a criminal assistant U.S. attorney who does healthcare work.
How did that happen?
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? So, you know, these things happen. HIPAA breaches happen all the time. And HIPAA disclosure happens all the time. But I think that the thing to keep in mind is that if you're going to start keeping some documentation that is protective in nature, you have to really think about what are you doing with those documents. You know, if you're going to write an internal email where you're going to disclose PHI in that internal email, then you have to think about: am I going to also make a physical copy of that document and take it? You know, and take it, you know, with me. I remember I dealt with something a few months ago with a provider who, he was dealing with the daughter of a patient, and the patient had some dementia issues, Alzheimer's, and the daughter was taking care of the patient, and the daughter was a bit of a pain in the butt, and the doctor got a little angry at the patient. And so what he did was he screenshotted something involving the patient's medical record. So he was in the EMR, screenshotted with his phone, and then texted that information to the daughter, because the mother can't impart the information to the daughter because the patient is suffering from dementia. The daughter kept peppering the front office staff and the doctor. And finally, the doctor just got annoyed. And, you know, he made a mistake. He made a humongous mistake.
Right.
And instead of having the daughter come in and pick up a copy of the record, or him mailing it or doing something with it, he screenshotted it, and over text he sent her a screenshot, and then had an immediate, oops, what did I do? Because then the daughter then reached out to him and said, you just violated HIPAA, and then made an entire separate argument. So it was like a non-winning, you know, situation.
Right.
But, you know, people, I think at the time that you're in the heat of it, and I think, you know, coders are a very passionate group of people, and coders and auditors, I think, are an even different level, but coders and auditors see things very black and white. And right is right and wrong is wrong.
Right.
And auditors even more so. You know, coders are looking at the four corners of the paper, and auditors are looking at 360 degrees of the patient. But it's very black and white and very passionate. And I think the one thing that I've really come to appreciate about coders and auditors is that when they see something that's wrong, they will shout from the rooftops that it's wrong.
Yes.
And will put themselves in positions where they put their job at risk and all of these other things at risk. And sometimes I think they're doing it without understanding what those ramifications are, because a coder or an auditor are sitting in a position where they believe, you've put me in this chair to do it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Without thinking about the fact that that's not always the way it is. You know, in the healthcare world, the provider community are not all in it to be appropriate and do the right thing, right? We see all the time healthcare providers sell their soul for $50 a referral. Mm-hmm. We see it in the telefraud world. As you know, Sean and Jordan and I talk about the telemedicine, the telefraud all the time. And I call it telefraud. Mm-hmm. I worked on a lot of these telefraud cases when I was an agent. I think they're horrible. I think that there's an important place for telemedicine. Most of the people that are involved in it, and to the level of extent, you're just preying upon people. And when you get down to the bottom end of the rung of the ladder, it's some doctor who's sitting in a room getting carpal tunnel syndrome from clicking. And they're doing it for, you know, the couple of cases I worked, I would literally joke about that. Like, how is this provider not getting carpal tunnel syndrome from clicking, literally clicking 50 prescriptions in 15 minutes?
Right.
So people will sell their soul for $50 or $25. And so coders and auditors who are really the first line of defense for that and have this, it's black and it's white. It's black and white to someone who does this and wants to do it the right way. It's not black and white to people who don't care about doing it the right way.
Right. So we are coming up on the end of our time. We had scheduled longer, and then you have a meeting coming up, which I would like to bring you back for a separate session, maybe like an additional hour, like a separate time, because I still haven't gotten through my list of questions that I wanted to talk to you about.
Absolutely.
I could talk to you for like 8 hours straight. Like, my record for the longest podcast interview was 5 hours. A discussion I had with someone, 5 hours. I could probably do 10 hours with you easily because I love your stories and I have so many questions. So for this portion, I want to wrap up with one question, and then hopefully we can reschedule for another time.
Absolutely.
And talk further about some other issues. So going back to like working for the OIG, what is the most outrageous scheme that you've ever investigated? And we'll wrap on this question.
Yeah. So it was one of my more recent ones, and outrageous meaning like, you got to be kidding me. And this is all public record. So there was a guy whose name is Seth Refus, R-E-H-F-U-S-S. He's currently finishing up probably his 60-month sentence. Seth Refus started a not-for-profit called Good Samaritans of America. And he started it originally to peddle and solicit people to become Medicare Advantage patients. He worked as a sales rep for a insurance company that was a broker for Medicare Advantage plans. And he was doing the number one thing that CMS prohibits, which is you cannot solicit. During open season, brokers cannot independently solicit for Medicare Advantage plans. But what he did was he started this organization called Good Samaritans of America under the guise that he was going to go into senior buildings and do talks on all of the low cost and free services available to those seniors. And what he would do is he would talk about all of these things that they could get and how the Good Samaritans of America was there to help them. Really, what he was doing was working as a broker to get people to agree to have him come back and talk to them about Medicare Advantage plans. And he would have them fill out solicitation cards so that it would look like the patient, the prospective client was filling out the card and mailing it to him. Like, yes, I'm interested. Please contact me. Mm-hmm. The perplexing thing is that none of the cards had stamps or postmarks on them. And they were all in handwriting that was relatively similar. But as time went on, he morphed into being a sales rep for a company that did genetic testing, swabbing for what they call PGX testing. He didn't do cancer screening. He did it for medication management purposes. And what he would do is he would come in, he would do a talk about getting, you know, low cost cell phone and wireless service and fresh food and transportation. By the way, all of the things that these seniors all knew about, because they all lived in low income buildings. So they had one important part of that, a social worker or a community caseworker and each other. So any of the things that he talked about, and all he would do is print up the forms and give them to them. But one of his big pitches was, you know, 95% of the people don't have adverse events as a result of taking Lipitor. You don't want to be one of those five people. You want to make sure that you don't die from taking Lipitor and not see your grandkids. We can swab you. And so what he would do afterwards is people would line up, they would get swabs, and then he would pay a kickback to different healthcare providers in the state. And what really was the most audacious was he then embarked on an expansion of the Good Samaritans of America to go national. And he posted advertisements on Craigslist looking for healthcare providers, NPPA, MD, who had a valid NPI in their state. And then what he was doing was he was going to train sales reps to get deployed around the country to go into these senior citizen buildings and do exactly what he was doing, and then pay these healthcare providers a fee based on volume to do nothing more than sign off on it. He did it. He had a business partner whose mother owned.
How many providers did he get to agree to do that? How many were doing that?
So he started off in New Jersey, where he had one provider who did it. And it gets very, very complicated as to why the provider wasn't charged. And I can't really go into a lot of the details, but ultimately the provider was getting on her Yahoo email account. She was getting requisitions that she was printing up and physically rubber stamping with her signature. He provided her with a rubber stamp. And then at some point they went to a digital signature and she was, you know, scanning them back and sending them mm-hmm. over a Yahoo account. But there were some very twisted kind of convoluted answers as to what made it difficult to charge her criminally with this. But at one point it was one provider in New Jersey where it started. It then moved on to another. And then as part of his expansion around the country, he actually had signed agreements. We stopped him. We arrested him, did a search warrant and arrested some other people. And we actually were able to put a stop to it about 2 weeks before he was embarking on what was close to a nationwide explosion of this project. When we arrested him, he had there was a map that he had in his home office of essentially what his plan was going to be. And the Craigslist ads were for probably about 8 or 10 states. He was going out as far as Arizona, Michigan, Arizona, Delaware, Pennsylvania. He was hitting a lot of states, and he had signed contracts with MDs, PAs, and NPs to sign off on these requisitions for patients who were being swabbed by sales reps who were physically going to go out and do the swabbing for the genetic testing on this. And it was the most audacious. It was a lot of fun to do. I actually sat in on a couple of his talks in these adult low-income buildings as if I worked there or if I was the son of one of the residents. It was pretty interesting to sit in and listen to his talk. He had recorded his talk so that he could train other reps so he could send his talk out on how he did it. His business model was essentially to pay people to be reps and give them a commission for getting the swabs and then reap the benefits of doing it. One of his early business partners was a guy whose mother owned a home health agency, and he did some work for his mother's home health agency, but he also would go in at night to the mother's office and go through all of the client files and then show up at the client's offices and swab them. So at one point, I think he swabbed every single home health patient that existed. It was a challenge. He signed his mother's name, who was a PA. He was signing his mother's name on some of the requisitions unbeknownst to her. So yeah, it was pretty audacious. To me, it was like, wow, like this was, but he had a website. The Good Samaritans of America had a website. He had a certification program where you can become a certified Good Samaritan of America, through their social work program or something. But never, you know, the entire intention of the business was to get people thinking, you know, that's the way he got in, because most of these low income buildings needed to do social services programs under their Section 8, under HUD requirements and things. And so they were happy to have him come in and do, you know, a 30-minute talk. He would do ice cream socials. So he would bring in ice cream and soda and he would do his presentation and he would pack the room. Because these senior citizens, they want some free ice cream. And at the end, they would fill out a form where they would say, I'm interested in the following things. And they would never get it. Or when they would get it, it would be 2-3 days later, they would get a package of information that had some of the things they asked for. But the person that was delivering the package of information was the guy that Seth worked with, who was a licensed broker for Medicare Advantage. So Seth was no longer licensed, so he couldn't sit and have the conversation. So his friend would show up, one of the people he worked with would show up with the package and say, oh, I have your application for your wireless, your free cell phone. Oh, by the way, you also noted that you were interested in zero copays.
Yeah, that's interesting. That reminds me a little bit of, you know, since I'm in the interventional radiology world and there's a lot of vascular stuff going on. And I don't know if you've read Dr. Marty McCary's book, The Price We Pay. Excellent book if you haven't read it. He talks about the predatory screenings that are done at community health fairs.
No, but I'm in the middle of reading License to Steal because I teach for a graduate program and I'm reading this for my students to use.
So it's just amazing to me that you have people that will go in to these low income in the community health fairs. They go in these low income areas. They're doing predatory screenings. Hey, you've got a vascular problem. We're going to refer you to the doctor. Then eventually you're getting a procedure. You know, you're getting a stent put in your leg. You're getting an angioplasty when most of these people don't need it. So it kind of reminds me of that. So, okay, one last question, like very quickly. So you said you had a badge and a gun. Did you ever have to pull your gun on anybody ever when you were out in the field?
I've never had to fire it, but the gun has been out.
Okay, then I definitely need to have you back because I want to hear that story about how that came about.
Sure. I'm excited to come back and talk to you. We can talk for hours. We can talk for hours.
Yes, thank you so much, Eric. I enjoyed it. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
See you too.
Bye.
That brings us to the end of part one of my interview with Eric Rubenstein. Be sure to tune in again in 2 weeks for part two. And don't forget to check out Coding Consultant Confessions, the new podcast hosted by myself, Tony L. Holmes, and Victoria Mall. And as always, I want to thank all of my listeners. If you are loving the podcast and listen on Apple, please take a moment to give the podcast a 5-star rating and leave a review. And as always, please share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. If you have feedback you'd like to share in an episode or a topic suggestion, please send an email to podcast@radrx.com. That's podcast@radrx.com. And I would still love to start an Ask Stacy segment, so please submit any questions you would like answered in a future episode to askstacy@radrx.com. That's Ask Stacy. Stacy is spelled S-T-A-C-I-E @radrx.com. Thanks again for tuning in and have an amazing week.
Thank you for listening to Who Cares What Stacy Says? You can connect with Stacy on social media. You can find her business page for RadRx on Facebook, and you can connect with her personally on LinkedIn. Don't forget to check out the online training courses offered by RadRx, Cracking the IR Code, Mastering Interventional Radiology and Cardiology Online Training, or Cracking the Diagnostic Radiology Code Online Training. Thanks again for tuning in to Who Cares What Stacy Says? A podcast providing insights and advice on how to take your medical coding career to the next level.